You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Can only come from you. Get to people, yeah.
What are you gonna
you gonna do?
Do you really think that?
Do you think it all?
Yeah. I never meant kids about
they
you.
Ain't giving up a second thought about you. No. Ghetto people.
Who you gonna turn to next?
Tell
ghetto
me.
People.
You gotta take a look at yourself. Yeah. Ghetto people. With your life
running like a red disease,
I'm running like a red disease. Ghetto people,
stop giving up yourself.
Stop doing what you're doing to yourself, young. You got to learn to love yourself. Yeah,
ghetto people.
You are listening to African Perspectives, where we review the issues of our day from an African worldview and African centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak, having been granted permission. To our ancestors, whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders, whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters, in the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet. It gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is truly an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. Everything on the planet that lives, it needs water, from a tiny microscopic organism to a tall redwood tree. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe, which simply means so be it. So we pour this libation to God for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity, everyone who has lived, everyone who will live in the future. We all have a common ancestral root in Africa. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet in the opening. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were others as well, as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe. Civilizations that were flourishing and growing while Europe was in a medieval or dark age. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu, an outstanding educational institution. So we pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the Ma'afa, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the Infakani, the great tragedy, uprooted out of Africa. Our brothers and sisters lay a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. We're in North America, South America, Central America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to our brothers and sisters who suffered the Ma'afa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the great tragedy. We pour this libation in their honor and in their memory. We do not know their names, but because of them and their sacrifice, we are here. So we say Ashe. We pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you will know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a captive want to do? Get free. So we pour this libation to all those men and women who fought against enslavement. In fact, I maintain that some of us are more of a slave today than we were in our initial captivity, because some of us are a slave to vice, to corruption, to drugs, sex, and violence. So we pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement: Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Dingmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman. We always resisted. And we will always resist. So we pour this libation in the name and the honor of those men and women who fought against our captivity. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We sashay. We pour this libation to brotherhood and sisterhood, together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good family life. There's a saying, conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is not good. Because why? We lack consciousness. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are historically, who you are culturally. So once we begin to understand the importance of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. Brothers and sisters, let us all say, Ashe, Ashe.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Brother Oshie. Hotep family, hope everything was well for you today. Hope you're going to have a good weekend. Hope you're going to get a chance. Hope you get a chance to do all the things you want to do, should do, must do, can do, and will do. And I hope the weather will be accommodating for you to do it. But of course, if it's not and it has to get done, it must get done, and you will get it done, and you will do it safely. That is our hope and prayer, always. Because we got to do work, family. We just can't procrastinate now. We got to do work. If we want to be independent, self-determining, liberated, and sovereign, it requires work. Not just verbalizing it, but physically doing it. We got to do work. So let's get busy. You're listening to African Perspectives. We're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 10 to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Mountain, or 8 to 10 Pacific, or any other time around the world. But if you cannot listen to this program live, you can always go to our archives at timeforanawakening.com. At the top of the page, you'll see podcasts. Click on that. The drop down, you'll see African Perspectives. Click on that, and there will be programs that are dated and titled. Other programming that we have here on Time for an Awakening Media. On Mondays, all times are going to give our Eastern times. On Mondays, from 6 to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds, public affairs programming with Brother Jihad Ahmed. That's followed by, from 8 to 9, Black Therapy Central with Dr. Mawia Kamban and Nataki Kamban. And then from 9 to 10, Conversations, Reparations with Brother Jamoke and Sister Lacey of Encobra. On Tuesdays, from 8 to 10, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers. On Wednesdays, the Black Farmers Report from 8 p.m. to 9. From 8 to 9 on Wednesdays, the Black Farmers Report. If it's Friday and it's 8 p.m. Eastern, brothers and sisters, you know it's time for an awakening. That's right, time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Time for an awakening on Fridays. Saturdays from 4 to 6, Sister Talk with host LaWanda Chambers. And then from 7 to 9 p.m., the Sankofa Elders Council. And back on Sunday at 7 p.m. Once again, it's time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And, of course, the number to call is 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. We Buy Black. We Buy Black, the largest online marketplace for American African-owned businesses, is WeBuyBlack.com. Get everything you need from American African-owned businesses from WeBuyBlack.com. These products are produced by us. For so much that you purchase, you'll have delivery free, free delivery. WeBuyBlack.com. Check it out. Africa for the Africans. Brother Bamani Taimba has been taking our people to the motherland for many years, over 400 of us. And his next trip is to Tanzania, and that is going to be November 18th through the 29th. All of his trips that I'm going to announce are $3,700, a $400 down payment, and you can pay on it. So you can be prepared for a trip of a lifetime. And everything that you need is right on the website, Africa40Africans.org. Africa40Africans.org. A trip to Ghana, December 24th to January 5th, 2022. Senegal and Gambia, April 1st to April 11th, 2022. And then on Ghana, then to Ghana again, May 24th to June 5th, 2022 to Ghana. And once again, they're $3,700. Everything you need is there. If you want to see pictures of previous tours, go to facebook.com/Bomani. If you want to see videos of previous tours, go to youtube.com/Bomani2007. In fact, on the website, there's a constant pictures that are updated from previous tours as well on the website. Africa for the Africans. Baba Rinoko, he's leaving tomorrow, family. Baba Rinoko Rashidi. He is going to Kemet, and what a great trip it's going to be. July 31st, tomorrow, to August 13th. On August 13th, brothers and sisters, I will be talking to Rinoko Rashidi on this program at 11 o'clock here and 5 p.m. in Kemet. It'll be 5 p.m. in Kemet, 11 o'clock here. We will have a conversation on the tour and other things. So I'm looking forward to that. Dr. Rinoko, go to drrunoko.com. drrunoko.com. Dr. Rinoko Rashidi. His phone number is 323-803-8663. 323-803-8663. 63. Habashaw Incorporated.org. The brothers and sisters are doing great work. Please go online to Habashaw Incorporated.org and understand the programs that they do and how you can invest or how you can support Habashaw Works, Black to Our Roots, Sustainable Seeds, Golden Growers, and Urban Green Jobs. The Kashi Project that is happening in Africa as we speak, they show the progress of the buildings being built and so forth. Habashaw Incorporated.org. The LEDGE Group. LEDGE stands for Land for the Environmental Development for Group Economics. The LEDGE Group. Go to theledgegroup.com and check it out for yourself, brothers and sisters. They deal with the four areas of human existence: food, water, clothing, and shelter. They have 12 projects in 6 different countries, and they employ over 170 people, and they have 260 members. They need more members. They need you to be a member of the LEDGE Group. If you are a member, and it costs $1,000 to be a member, it is well worth it. You have the opportunity to buy land in Tanzania, or some people don't pronounce it Tanzania, but they pronounce it Tanzania. So you have opportunity to buy an acre of land for $250. Ain't talking about bull, you know, because if you know Tanzania, that's Mount Kilimanjaro, the Serengeti, beautiful. So, brothers and sisters, go to theledgegroup.com. TheLedgeGroup.com. Bibi Atumi. ABIBITUMI.com. BibiAtumi.com, brothers and sisters. This is the website you should be on. You should go there and stay there for home information, shopping, all kinds of things that you can buy, clothing and so forth. The different events that it has, the languages that you can learn. Kiswahili, Medu Netcher, Ifa, many more. Brothers and sisters, go to BB Atumi, ABIBITUMI.com. Let me do it this way. I'm going to go to ULU, Us Lifting Us, the Economic Development Cooperative for Our People in the Spirit of Ujamaa. Us Lifting Us, the Economic Development Cooperative in the Spirit of Ujamaa. Their Thursday night broadcast last night went well, and that is at 9 p.m. every Thursday night at 9 p.m. from 9 to 10 on blogtalkradio.com, blogtalkradio.com/ULU. If you want to call just to listen, you can do that. And, of course, ask questions, you can do that. And The number to call is 929-477-2789. That's 929-477-2789. Us, lifting us, the economic development cooperative for our people. Wadada's Healthy Market and Juice Bar. This week at Wadada's Healthy Market and Juice Bar, they have delicious smoothies and fruit drinks and health drinks and pastries and all kinds of good stuff, soups and everything. And on Saturday and Sunday, they have vegan catering. That's right. Saturday and Sunday have vegan catering. And so it is well worth it. And so, brothers and sisters, check it out. Check it out. Oh, my goodness. I hit something and I've lost my place. But that's okay. We'll get it back. I had a whole bunch of stuff. I'm going to have to take a break to bring this stuff back up. Something happened to my computer. Man, I hate when that happens, don't you? Yeah, I'm going to have to play a little something in the interim while I correct this. But first, let me finish with these announcements. The Medu Bookstore in the Greenbrier Mall, Mama Nia, has a nice location. She's right on the strip there in the Greenbrier Mall. Give Mama Nia a call at 404-346-3263, 404-346-3263. If you're in the Greenbrier Mall, please stop by and browse. If she doesn't have the book that you're looking for, believe me, she'll get it for you. She has a fine selection of books, postcards, greeting cards, certificates, figurines, T-shirts, all kinds of good stuff. That's the Medu Bookstore in the Greenbrier Mall. The Black Dot Cultural Center and Bookstore in Lithonia, my good brother Kazimde Ajamu, the proprietor, has a beautiful coffee bar serving delicious African coffees and teas and pastries and bean pie. Yeah. So check out brother Kazimde Ajamu. Give him a call at 404-519-8107. That's 404-519-8107. The Black Dot Cultural Center and Bookstore. Brothers and sisters, there is light in the black dot. Sun Goddess Scents. Sun Goddess Scents, your one-stop natural shop located at 4140 Jonesboro Road in Forest Park, Georgia. Inside the International Discount Mall, booth 225. For more information, contact our sister, Shelly Armanset, at 404-434-7963. That's 404-434-7963. Sun Goddess Scents, your one-stop natural shop in the International Discount Mall. Sanjay-Aiti. Sister Gabrielle really is doing a great job in the northeastern portion of the island of Haiti. Go to Sanjay, SONJE-AYITI.org. Sanjay-Aiti. Beautiful children in their school uniforms because they deal with education, healthcare, sustainable agriculture, and entrepreneurship. Sanjay-Aiti. The Shrine of the Black Madonna, which is open on Fridays and Saturdays from 1 to 7. They are partnering with the Universal Negro Improvement Association for the Marcus Garvey Commemoration Festival on Saturday, August 14th. Saturday, August 14th. Also, too, I just think about it, that the date I'm going to be talking with Renoco on the 13th is Friday the 13th. That's right. Love it. That's a great day. Friday the 13th. And, of course, on Saturday, August 14th, at the Shrine of the Black Madonna, in that area they have there in a lot, they'll have drummers, market, vendors, dancers, singers, healthcare, you name it, they're going to have it. Brothers and sisters, if you want to vend, give the Shrine a call or you and I a call at 404-254-5122. That's 404-254-5122. Or stop by. Once again, the Shrine is open from 1 to 7, so you can stop by the Shrine today and tomorrow and see if you can get you a place. Ackerman Institute. Oh, man, I don't even have that. Well, yeah, I got a good... oh, shucks. I'm not going to do that ever. I'm not going to do that again. I'll tell you what. I'm going to play a little something-something. And then when we come back, I hope to be ready to do it. And let me see here. What am I going to play? It's Friday. You know, I like upbeat songs. In fact, the songs I got for you Friday is Iceman's Band. It's Get Down to That and Body Heat by Quincy Jones. Two Friday songs. You know, a Friday song to me is a song that gets you pumping and jamming, okay?
And here's a good Friday song for those who want to go out and do some stepping. So let's make this one happen, okay? All right. Wrong one. I hit the wrong one. This is the right one. Chicago Steppin'. Welcome back, brothers and sisters. That little music interlude right there for you. Shake Down. I think it's a good Friday song, isn't it? Makes you want to get to the club and do some stepping. Love it. We are, let me see here. Let me give you some direction. I'm going to read the Inye Sesim, of course. The Inye Sesim of Daily Revolutionary Thought. July 29th. Our history is our collective memory, and without it, we are lost. Studying our history gives us direction and keeps us anchored. When we are disorientated, we surrender to others' directions of where we should be going and others' definitions of who we are. It's impossible to obtain our optimum development. That's right, it's impossible to obtain our optimum development. If our total memory of self has been erased, the erasing of our memory makes us vulnerable to the oppressive definition of who we are and what we are, because there's nothing in our memory to debunk what we are told. Our collective amnesia is what maintains our psychological enslavement. I repeat, our collective amnesia is what maintains our psychological enslavement. Ifa Asada Fatu. Imagine being in a state of starvation every day of your life, every single solitary moment of every day from birth to death. Imagine the violent denial of food, the stress and fear of stealing even one crumb, one stalk, one leaf. The desperation muzzled in mental amnesia feels aplenty. Imagine the psychotic trauma of intergenerational starvation, of malnourished eggs and sperm developing in depleted wombs, leftover breast milk followed by a lifetime of discarded scraps. Imagine daily waking to a life of tormenting hunger and under and malnourishment has a way of life. of all the physical damage during our enslavement, starvation is the least of what we can now see and feel. Its vestiges evident among only of a limited number of our impoverished. Imagine people having to become full from there. Sadly, even though we now have more on our plates, often excessively, more than ever before, we remain in the same situation relative to our physical existence. Nutritionally, we have become healthy slaves from which labor can be extracted over a longer number of years. Affirm, I study and remember. July 30th. If you respect yourself, you'll respect your partner. If you respect your partner, your partner will respect you. T. Owens Moore. Reciprocity encourages correctness. Build trust and facilitate the level of meaningful dialogue which follows love to grow among frontline warriors who can then more confidently build the framework out of which our people can move toward an absolute incontestable sovereignty. Because of the depth of intimacy involved, complementarity, the bonding of a man and a woman permanently committed to each other in love and vision is most conducive to reciprocity. At the heart of these powerful relationships is trust. It is critical to their stability and the foundation of respect each person involved has for the other. Trust and respect cannot exist or thrive without the other. And in any reality, especially this one, trust and respect are a private affair. For this reason, compliments keep secrets with, not from, each other. Trust among these intimate couples is sacred. It must be treated as invaluable, for there can be no true relationship in the presence of deceit. Marriage, the apex of complementarity, disciplined character through sacrifice, the greatest evidence of respect. Giving what could easily have been kept is one of the most fundamental evidence of our respect for another person. Affirm the respect my compliment and the love we have for each other is reciprocal. Affirm the respect my compliment and the love we have for each other is reciprocal. Reciprocity, you reap what you sow. July 31st, for Black people to talk about building up the Black community, mirroring other Black people, spending money in the Black community, educating the children in the community, and supporting other Black people is neither racism nor racist. It is collective self-preservation and good common sense. My good brother, Dr. Rinoco Rashidi. This is ironic, isn't it? He's leaving for Kemet tomorrow, and he's in the Inye Sasim today. How ironic. Identify as African, as who I am. I do not identify with menticide, as Negroes and lost souls do, or with some fantasy stolen from what I envy and can never possibly be, as Urugu does. I only identify with my African warrior ancestors, the African warriors who are now uncompromisingly being on the front line and the vision of the African warriors. And the African warriors in training who are being reared by those warriors to be the power in our future and the generations of Africans they themselves will produce to carry forth nothing less than our sovereign torch. I identify as African, as who I am, always have been, and always will be. Ashe. And affirm in every area of life and living, I identify as African. Affirm in every area of life and living, I identify as African. I'm going to send that, I'm going to make note of that to Rinoco. As I said, on the 13th of August, he will be my guest from Kemet. Brothers and sisters, it's a good day. It's Friday. I have a website that I like that I'm going to be reading a lot from, African history. And I chose this. I'm going to probably do this one again next year
when that time comes, and it's important that we understand that all the lies that have been told about us in Kemet, which was the height, the apex, the zenith, the pinnacle of African high culture. You know, here's a quote by Dr. Sheikh Anta Diop. Black people ignore that their ancestors who adjusted to the material conditions in the Nile Valley are the oldest guides of humankind on the way to civilization. That's right. We are the foundation. So no, the title of this program today is No, the Hebrews were not slaves in Kemet. The Hebrews were not in captivity in Kemet. Ancient Kemetic people are perceived by the followers of Abrahamic religions, mainly, as the cruelest people of ancient times. The Abrahamic religions, of course, are Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. All three have stories taken from each other, and particularly about ancient Kemet being an evil place where the pharaohs and made Hebrews toil to build temples and tombs and whatever, and were in captivity for 400 years. Never happened. This is due to the biblical story of Exodus written by the first Hebrews, of which narrates the alleged attempted extermination and enslavement and a fleeing of the Hebrews from Africa. Through the Torah, they have drafted under the guidance of Ezra, the scribe, the Jews spread the theory according to which they are the people chosen by God. They are people, which of course many people believe today. And of course, to me, you know, God doesn't choose, you choose God. God didn't come and say, you are my chosen one. Because that sends a rift through all other people, particularly those who are God-fearing. Well, God, why don't you choose me or choose us? And when you look at the story of them, how deceitful they were, how they continued to do things, I mean, God should have said, hell with y'all. Be getting some more pious people, some people who, you know, will understand. But anyway, it won't be good for the story. But the story has had deleterious effects on humanity. The Hebrew story has had look at today. Whew. Therefore, they are supposedly, and the people they allegedly caused them the greatest harm in the beginning are believed to be the most evil ever. As Christianity and Islam pretty much stem from Judaism, the purpose, the supposed punishment inflicted upon the Hebrews' ancestors by Africans of the Pharaonic era have been relayed through these religious and spread across the world. Ancient Kemetic people are therefore seen as wicked people by a great part of humankind. Even present-day Africans who have been raised with these religious so-called holy books join the condemning voices to vilify Kemetic people. And that's what bothers me. When I hear Muslims, even the Nation of Islam, use these analogies of pharaohs and pharaoh's house, Christians particularly, and others, when they discovered that Kemetic people were African and that their own ancestors rejected by Christianized and Islamized Africans is not toned down quite often. The Kemetic civilization and its innumerable knowledge so useful to restore today's Africa are hardly adopted. That bears repeating, that the knowledge of what we had done prior is what could be and what must be our salvation. What is the truth about the Exodus story? Are these very serious accusations against Egyptians true, or Kemetic people true? We'll provide some answers, we hope. This article supplements the one on the existence or not of slavery system in ancient African societies. Before discussing the Hebrew issue, it is necessary to ask the general question, did Kemetic people practice slavery? The answer provided by archaeology has been clear with and has been clear for quite a while. No. One may think that a system existed in all ancient societies. That is not the case in Kemet, deeply rooted in the African pacifist philosophy of Ma'at, was a society free of forced labor. It was no captivity happened. Once again, I refer, excuse me. Once again, I refer to the documentary that you can see on YouTube, Great Pyramid K 2019. Great Pyramid K 2019. It substantiates that no, nothing was built by slaves. It was built by the people themselves, and they were paid. Egyptian monuments to Amon, to God, Amun-Ra, his or her manifestations, the other deities, his or her intermediaries, the ancestors and royalty, were built by workers who were paid and were even entitled to the right to strike. The word slave, thus, is unknown to the Kemetic language. The slave comes out of Europe, Slavic, slave. Furthermore, Kemetic monuments were built with an accuracy and a meticulousness never equaled in history. A captive would never be motivated to line up stones, blocks, to the nearest millimeter. This is the work of dedicated and enthusiastic people. The most prominent researchers of the last decades have been of this opinion. The Honorable Sheikh Anjan Jop mentioned the Kemetic inalienable freedoms. Geographer and historian Louis Diop-Mies added during a conference in Paris that it was prohibited to coerce laborers. Kemetic Robert Jacques Turbo said, contrary to common perception spread through centuries, Pharaonic Kemet did not use captives for the construction of their temples and monuments dedicated to their kings. Dr. Awas, the Arab Dr. Awas, and the American Mark Lanner added, contrary to common perceptions still spread by some tour guides recently, the pyramids were not built by slaves or foreigners. I repeat, they were not built by slaves or foreigners. Nothing in the history of Kemet enables to detect the slightest truce of private slavery. Dr. Theophilo Benga gives details on the workers' living condition and says these workers receive daily bread, beer, beer, nice cold beer. Probably wasn't cold though. Damn ice, nice cold beer. Fish, dates, vegetables, and on occasion, special festivals, meat from the pharaonic administration. They were also provided with drinking water every day. They were equally supplied with sandals. Each craftsman received a fixed salary in the form of cereals and sometimes also in precious metals. Payment was made at the beginning of the month and advanced by the royal treasury. Jacques Pernier added, what indeed defines the Kemetic civilization and distinguishes it from all other ancient civilizations is, on the one hand, the fact that it did not experience captivity or enslavement, and on the other hand, it gave women an equal status to men. Let me repeat. The fact that it did not experience slavery, and on the other hand, it gave women an equal status to men. Not only didn't the Kemetic practice slavery, but it is clear from the study of this civilization that although they were not perfect, our most glorious ancestors were very pious and human thanks to Ma'at. They were very pious and human thanks to Ma'at. It is this humanity that still defines them when they came in contact with Hebrews, deconstructing the Exodus, the arrival of Hebrews in the African world. As a reminder of Hebrew ancestors are Semitic, engendered by whites born in the northern Eurasia. The Semitic people went down into Middle East, populated at the time by Sumerian Africans. Sumerians. They designated that the land of Mesopotamia in the Middle East, so-called Middle East, has their historical cradle. As a polytheistic people believing in several gods, the Semites, symbolized by Abraham, migrated to Kemet in present-day Near East, a country also inhabited by Africans in ancient times. When Abraham arrived in Canaan, he met the Canaanites called the Amalekites in the Bible. Genesis chapter 14, verse 18 to 19 tells us about this meeting, saying, Amalekite king Salam brought bread and wine. He was a priest of the Most High God. And he blessed Abram and said, blessed be Abram by the Most High God, the Lord of heaven and earth. Abraham, a character representing the Semites, was therefore welcomed by the African Canaanites and Phoenicians, who gave him food and introduced him into the knowledge of the one God venerated by Africans since the beginning. The Bible goes on to narrate Abram's interaction with Kemet. He had a son, Ishmael, with the African handmaiden, Hagar. A series of interactions between the Semites and the African world followed. Abraham, the Semites, were therefore welcomed by the Africans, who showed them hospitality. Then he lived amongst Africans until his death. According to the Bible, he died and was buried in Canaan with his wife Sarah. After him, the descendants Isaac and Jacob and others also interacted with the African world and were welcomed there. But such interactions remained sporadic and embryonic at first. Why don't people notice in the Bible that the African Canaanites, Egyptians offer hospitality to the Semites, the Hebrews, welcome them into their land and allowing them to live and flourish there? Can this hospitality be comparable with the Kemetic alleged wickedness? Can it be compatible with the curse ascended by the Canaanites according to biblical Genesis? No. This is the behavior of kind and human people guided by Ma'at. During Jacob's life biblical episode, a group of Hebrews arrived in Kemet. Has Jacob's name changed to become Israel at the moment of his life? Semites arrived in Kemet from Canaan as Israel's sons. This episode is recounted in the book of Genesis, chapter 46, verses 2 through 7. And God spoke to Israel in a vision at night and said, do not be afraid to go to Egypt, for I will make you into a great nation there. Then Jacob left Beersheba, and Israel's sons took their father Jacob and their children and their wives in carts that Pharaoh had sent to transport them. So Jacob and all his offsprings went to Kemet, taking with them their livestock and possessions that they had acquired in Canaan. Jacob brought with him to Egypt his sons and grandsons and his daughters and granddaughters, all of his offspring. When Jacob, Israel, arrived in Kemet with his family, and the Bible says in the book of Genesis, chapter 46, verse 27, the members of Jacob's family went into Egypt, were 70 in all. There's a relief, a piece of authentic pharaonic with Amenhotep II's tomb, dated around 1900 BCE, before the present era. At the top, we can see Semitic people arriving peacefully and officially in Kemet for the first time. Egyptians are the ones depicted at the bottom of this relief. You can see that they are dark, the people, see. After living happily in Canaan, where they acquired properties, it is said that the Hebrews were transported by the chariots generously sent by the Pharaoh for their departure for Africa. What happened to the Hebrews, 70 people, when they arrived in Kemet? They were welcomed by our ancestors from the Nile Valley. Now the Israelites settled in Kemet and in the region of Goshen. They acquired property. They were fruitful and increased greatly in number. That's what it says in Genesis. How long did the Hebrews stay in Africa to feed themselves, to be housed, to multiply, learn, and enjoy all the benefits of Kemet and the civilization and the civilization's elements? It is said in the book of Exodus 12, chapter 12, verse 40. Now, the length of time the Israelite people lived in Kemet was 430 years. The Bible talks about a happy state for centuries until came to power a new Pharaoh who would be cruel to the Hebrews, the Exodus Pharaoh. Then a new king to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Kemet. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. If war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Ramesses stores and cities for the Pharaoh. Who was this Pharaoh who started causing harm to the Hebrews? If we rely on this text, it is Ramesses II. The passage indicates that the city of Ramesses was built by enslaved children of Israel for the Pharaoh. The city mentioned, certainly P. Ramesses, capital city by Ramesses Marianne Pitoum, is according to the National Geographic per Atum, another city built by the Pharaoh. Except that there is absolutely no evidence of a people stronger than the Egyptians at that time in Egypt. When the king built his capital city, he had already conquered Western Asia and the Sudan and was probably the world's most powerful man at the time. Moreover, Kemetic people were African at the time. And although they became various foreign people, none of them competed with them in number and power on their land. The internal situation in Kemet described by the Bible is therefore imaginary. Furthermore, it is very likely that no kings would revere, because no king was revered as much as Ramesses. After his death in the history of Kemet, 9 pharaohs carried his name forth to equal his greatness and prosperity that he had brought in, a record. If the Hebrews, God, had cursed and furiously punished Kemet for the mistreatment of Israel's children, as narrated by the Bible, everything would have been done to forget the king as the Egyptians did for other pharaohs. According to the treatment of his workers, the great king was nowhere close to a slaver, and thus said, O chosen and valiant workers, O you are the good fighters who refuse to be fatigued, who carry out the work with firmness and efficiency. I will not spare you my blessings. Food will be overwhelmed for you. I will provide for you in every way, so you will work for me with a loving heart. I am the defender of you. Your food will be very capricious, for I truly know your hard work, for which the worker can only be jubilant when his belly is full. I have also set up a large staff to meet your needs, fishermen who bring you fish, other gardeners will grow vegetables, potters will make consistently to have many pitchers manufactured for you, so water will be fresh in the summer season. Moreover, there is no evidence of enslavement and attempts to eliminate people at that time. The Pharaoh left many monuments and writings in Kemet and in the Sudan, and there is absolutely no trace of this. He also liked to talk about his victories in very pompous ways. If he had thus had an upper hand over a particular people, he would have publicized it. Hell, if he'd have stubbed his toe, that would have been known. So why these things did not happen? The Bible comes on and says in Exodus 2, chapter 2, verse 23, yet another long time the king of Egypt died. It is therefore under Ramesses' successor, Merpatah, that the plagues of Egypt and the Hebrews escaped are believed to have taken place. According to the plagues of Egypt, there is no historical evidence of their occurrence.
the only events which comes close to them back date back to 300 to 400 years before their rule. We're talking about the impact of the Sunyari Island explosion in the Mediterranean, then a period of climate change which had nothing to do with God Yahweh's punishment. When the children of Israel ran away, the book describes Egyptians' reaction to the Exodus, chapter 14, verse 6. So he, the Pharaoh, had his chariot made ready and took his army with him. After the much vaunted opening of the Red Sea and the drowning of the Egyptians who were pursuing the Hebrews, Exodus chapter 14, verse 28 says, the water flowed back and covered the chariots and the horsemen. The entire army of Pharaoh had followed the Israelites into the sea, and no one of them survived. And not one of them survived. First, we rely on the reader's basic reasoning to conclude that the sea cannot open in the middle. Of course, in biblical terms, God can do anything. Then the text tells us that the Pharaoh and all his army drowned. Well, of course, we all know there is the mummy of Ramesses II, who died at the age of 90, and other pharaohs that died. None of them drowned, not one. After the fantastic crossing of the Red Sea, the Hebrews are said to have spent 40 years in the desert to reach Canaan. It is simply impossible, no matter the route taken, cannot take that long to reach Jerusalem from present-day Qatar. Even if we consider an exaggerated distance of 1,000 kilometers, there is 68 meters per day. That span was randomly chosen. Moreover, as the Israelite historian Salom Sand pointed out at a conference in the United States, where he refuted the Exodus myth, Canaan was a territory under the Egyptian Empire at the time and even for centuries. Therefore, the Hebrews allegedly fled from Egypt into Egypt. The Aswan High Dam was not built, of course, until later 50s. And that landmass was all connected. They built the dam so you could go from the Red Sea into the Mediterranean and vice versa for commerce. So you can go from the Mediterranean into the Red Sea, into India and other parts east of there, or vice versa, and go west of there. So that landmass was there. That was a part of Kemet. In Exodus 16, verses 2 and 3, the Bible once again reveals the welfare presumably always enjoyed by the Hebrews in Kemet. When the Hebrews found themselves in the desert under Moses' leadership, they began to miss Egypt on their way to Canaan. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, if only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into this desert to starve the entire assembly to death. This passage is found in Enoch in the Gospels, particularly in John 8:33, where the Hebrew said, we are Abraham's descendants and have never been slaves to anyone. Then to summarize, the Egyptians did not practice slavery because they believed in Ma'at. The truth, justice, reciprocity, harmony, order, balance. They believed in Ma'at. That's what guided society. They were pacifists unless you moved on them and they can get their army together and kick your ass. The Hebrews came from Mesopotamia, were welcomed with open arms by the African Canaanites and the Kemites. The Hebrews posed no danger to Ramesses in time to justify their enslavement. Ramesses was very loving toward his workers. He was not a slaver. The plagues of
The plagues on Egypt never happened. It never occurred. The sea cannot open in the middle. Neither Ptah nor any other pharaoh died from drowning. There is no evidence of the Kemetic army disappearance. It is impossible to walk for 40 years to cover a distance between Kemet and Canaan, which is a part of the same, is part of Egypt, or is part of Kemet. Other biblical passages suggest that the Hebrews always live happily in Kemet and not as slaves. It makes no sense to flee from Egypt to go to Egypt. In a paper entitled Max Doubt in the Desert, the University of Western Australia wrote, "The Israelite exodus from Egypt is clearly the most important event in the Hebrew Bible, and yet there is currently no direct archaeological evidence to support this tradition." Understand something. Everything in the Bible is supposed to be true. Everything in the Bible is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And the Old Testament, and of course the New Testament, it has to be true. And understand this, brothers and sisters. Not only does it have to be true, it must be historical. It must have happened the way they say it happened historically. One of Israel's most renowned newspapers has devoted an article to the subject entitled, "Were Hebrews Ever Slaves in Kemet?" "Yes," it says. We direct a reader to the paper in question. The author tries superficially and unsuccessfully to prove that slavery existed in Egypt. As for slavery of the Hebrews themselves, he provides absolutely no evidence. No evidence. The Jerusalem Post, another renowned newspaper, is much franker than it and admits the following in this article. The Exodus, does archaeology have a say? The short answer, whether or not Exodus really happened, is no. The whole subject of the Exodus is embarrassing to archaeologists. The Exodus is so fundamental to us and our Jewish sources that it is embarrassing that there is no evidence outside of the Bible to support it. There is nothing in Egyptian records to support it. Now, I know that some Christians will say that the reason why you don't see it because the Pharaoh was so embarrassed by what was happening. Because, you know, if he stubbed his toe, it was written. So let it be written, you know. But these 10 plagues, the locusts, the boils, this, that, and the other, the death of the firstborn, none of these things happened. There is nothing in Kemetic records to support it. Nothing on the slavery of the Israelites. Nothing on the plagues that persuaded Pharaoh to let them go. Nothing on the miraculous crossing of the Red Sea. Nothing. Nothing at all. Is there anything true in the Exodus myth? This story, which, as far as we know, never existed, could have, however, been inspired by two events in Kemet. The first was the victory over the Hyksos. The Hyksos, brothers and sisters, were the first people to come in. Okay, Brother Sean, I'm going to answer that question when you get a chance to take a break in a minute after I get done reading this here particular piece and we come back from the break. I appreciate it. When Pharaoh took over the whole country, he was very hard on the Hyksos and their allies, possibly including the Hebrew ancestors. Perhaps the memory of these fair punishments and settlements accounts to liberate Africa was an inspiration, possibly. Because, you know, the Hyksos, they came in and they stayed a minute. They stayed a minute until they were expelled. In fact, it is said that every invasion was a detriment to Kemenic people. Every invasion in the Hyksos, but they did not change the culture. They did not change a damn thing. The second was Akhenaten's rule. At his death, the authorities who remained faithful to the original cult of Amon and all the deities undertook to repeal the Pharaoh's reform, which concurred the central cult to the sun Aten, the main manifestation of Amon, and of which Akhenaten had declared himself the only prophet. The Hebrews allegedly remained faithful to Akhenaten's teachings because it was just the one God teachings. And of course, the Israelites and the Hebrews, and of course, the Christians and even the Muslims all follow suit. The Hebrews allegedly remained faithful to Akhenaten's teachings under the guidance of Egyptian priest Sher Joseph, follower of Akhenaten. They were then expelled from Kemet. It is the life which partly inspires the invention of Moses. I can't pronounce the name. Why inventing of the Exodus? The Hebrews were generally welcomed by the Canaanites and the Egyptians, who taught them religion and all civilizational elements. It is still Egypt under Sudan, Pharaoh Shabaka, and the general Taharqa, this is the 25th dynasty, who saved the Hebrews from destruction by the Assyrians in Jerusalem. This battle took place 700 before the present era. How then can we explain that the Hebrews demonized the Kemetic people and the Canaanites afterwards? It is clear about the Canaanites. It was necessary to take their land from them. Hence the invention of the promised land occurred and the biblical curse of blacks through the Canaanites. It was necessary to sentence the Canaanites to slavery, supposedly ordered by God to justify their extermination and to take over their possessions. Concerning the Egyptian, one does not know well. It is grudges from the time of the Hyksos or Akhenaten. It is rather unlikely. More likely, as the Egyptians were powerful, they were to be defeated by God in a drama intended to show that God had chosen the Hebrews over all others, even above the strongest that ever were. However, the way the Bible and the Quran treats our ancestors for something they did not do, whereas they were human, is extremely problematic. It is this curse of blacks in the Bible that led to anti-African racism in the world that we experience today. The Egyptians dominated the world for 2,000 years and were the first masters of the earth. They, too, had the means, as others do since 500 years, to exterminate entire people and plunder the whole planet. Instead, they spread civilization on every continent and propagated Ma'at, the humanistic idea. It is the pacifist and humanist idea of Ma'at that one finds in Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, daughter religions of Kemet and Sudan, and African spirituality. The Exodus myth, invented from scratch, brings ancient Kemetic people to dispute, and it must be debunked. It is indispensable to Africans to restore their most glorious ancestors' image. We should do so not only because they are our ancestors and our parents, but we owe them that loyalty. But we also, for the Kemetic knowledge to be fully and proudly embraced by the entire African world, as tomorrow Africa will have to build on it. That's right, Africa will have to build on it. Brothers and sisters, we're going to take a break. We come back from the break. I'll take these calls. I got a number of people, and I'll get to you, Brother Sean. So, once again, brothers and sisters, this is African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. We'll be right back. You stay with us.
You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshi on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Touch me. temperature's rising, and it's not surprising. But when you're close to me, girl, it's so tantalizing. I can't help myself, I get so excited. Why do I act in this fashion? Why can't I control my passion? Some call it soul fire.
Yeah.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Once again, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. Quincy Jones, Body Heat, and the Iceman, Jerry Butler, the Iceman's band, down to that. Oh, man, songs of the 70s, brother. But you know I play songs of the 70s. Y'all know that. And a few others that are more contemporary, and some even from past. So, hey, it's like that. I'm going to forgo the announcements. I'm going to get right to some questions. Because this is a deep topic. This is some serious stuff. Because this is what holds our community's mind, where we cannot come together and do for ourselves. We just don't understand what a deep hold that this theology and the theologies of outside of Africa that we embrace, what it does to us. So I'm going to go to Brother Sean. Brother Sean, how you doing? How you been, man?
Man, it's been a while, man.
Yes, it has.
Been a while.
Good to hear. I've been busy. Yeah, it's good to hear. You've been busy, I understand, but it's good to hear from you, brother.
I guess the one thing I had a question about was, you know, in that documentary, they basically are saying that, you know, Kemetic people use giant lenses to cut rock, okay? Now,
no, they
I
use
gotta see, I gotta
they
see.
They use giant lenses to melt rock. That's what they use to melt granite. They didn't use lenses to, yeah. You know, but when you look at the
I guess my question is, like, has anyone done that? I mean, I mean the idea of like that as an idea is great, but how do you demonstrate that?
I guess.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I guess, because there was another brother who had the same question posed to me. Of course, I don't have the answer. I've watched the documentary numerous times. I will continue to watch it to be as informed as I can be, because I agree with the documentary. You know, I agree that.
I mean, I do too. Like, everything else was on point. I'm just thinking, like, they kind of, that was just a bit of a twist. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, there could be a completely other method that we use to cut the stone. But I mean, the idea that there are statues that are made out of solid rock, you know what I'm saying, that couldn't be formed any other way is very intriguing.
Yes.
Like, and I would love to see someone make a giant lens and melt rock and do something like that, because otherwise it's hard to say that that's the case. It's just an idea.
I agree with you. You know, that would be interesting that they, but as you know, when you take a magnifying glass,
yeah,
and you go out into the sun and you put that on the back of your hand or the palm of your hand and so forth, and you let it stay there for a minute, when you get it to the smallest, you know that it burns the hell out of you. And so
yes,
the idea is that they built a bigger lens, more intense heat, as you've seen in the animations, in the illustrations, uh-huh, that they did. And they moved that lens. And what is interesting to me, it's plausible to me, is they did not let that technology out because they knew that others would try their best to come and take it from them, to kill them and take it from them. So that's why wherever they went with those mathematics of pi, the royal number, all of these things, the meter, wherever they went with that, and they built, yeah, with that. And they had other societies, as the documentary has shown, that even when we left and a temple or tomb was not complete, they couldn't complete it. Those indigenous people could not complete it because they did not have particularly that technology of the solar disk. They didn't have that. They may have had how to mix limestone and water and other elements to make it solid, pour it into a mold, and then lift the mold off before it got, and then let it dry, and bam, you got a solid stone that may weigh a ton or more, or 2 tons, which is,
yeah,
2 tons is 4,000 pounds. A ton is 2,000 pounds, you know. And you can see at the beginning of the documentary
when you had brothers and sisters by the Great Pyramid. And I've been there myself. I've sat on some of those rocks that are exposed, some of those stones that are exposed. And you can see how heavy they are and solid they are, and where you cannot even put, as they say, a piece of paper between them, because they were poured, and the mold was taken off, and the next one into the next one to the next one, and to constantly elevating them, you know?
Yes.
When I used to tell young people about the beauty of ancient Kemet, because I felt it was important that we understand ancient Kemet, because that is the foundation of knowledge throughout the world. And it was us. It was African people. It wasn't mulattoes. It wasn't Hebrews. It wasn't Hex. It was nobody. It was us, African people, just as the documentary says. Dark, melanated people. They're the only people that could work in that kind of environment for that long. And so what I said back then was that we traveled down the Nile River to quarries and, chiseled the stone and made them perfect, and then transported them into a barge and then sailed them down river, which is going from south to north, to the Giza Plateau. But there were so many pyramids in Kemet, as well as the Sudan. In fact, there's more than the Sudan. So then it couldn't be that kind of intensive labor that it would require of moving stone, because even the burial of the people, they weren't all racked and with back pain, and the skeletons were all deformed because they lifting 2 tons of stone.
Yeah.
See, so there's so much evidence to support what the documentary is talking about. It's suggesting that happened. So I agree with you. I think what needs to happen is that it is demonstrated that they create, because I'm quite sure they can, laser, a solar disc.
And the thing is, with glass, when you have like really delicate technology, like when you have glass, like glass can break, and then over time it won't last long. You know, the glass will dissolve, and all that. So it's not implausible that there's no lenses around yet because the glass breaks.
Yeah.
There is one more thing I wanted to talk about, if I may.
Sure, please.
It goes back to the topic you're talking about with the Bible and you know how dates are misconstrued. You know about creationism, right? That is basically what I think a lot of this is going towards, the idea that, you know, God said so, it was real, and this is how it always was. Now, have you ever heard of something called Last Thursdayism? That's like a branch of creationism.
No, I have not. It's basically
the same idea. It's just that, you know, God, you know, everything, you know, it's as if, you know, God made the world last Thursday, and everything that happened before then is just a creation of the creator itself. Like even the idea is that, you know, it's just not, you know, just a series of like a idea, you know, thought exercises saying that, you know, God could have made the world 5 minutes ago. You know, okay. If anything happened, you know, because of the Garden of Eden, because of the Genesis and all that, you know, everything happened then, and then everything else on the earth is like the devil's tricks. And I think that creationism, when we talk about what's going on in the world today, is that our people we're told to like basically not, you know, trust, you know, any kind of like circumstantial or empirical evidence of what's going on.
Exactly. You refute that. You only rely on the word of God. If you feel that it's not in the Bible, then it's not true. It's of the devil, you know? And so anything outside of that, that's why when I became more knowledgeable in the history of our people, it truly always bothered me that ministers, Christian as well as Muslims, condemned Egypt or Kemet. They condemned it, you know, and yet Kemet was the light of the world. In fact, its history now shows that
it brought a lot of information and knowledge and history, as you've seen by that documentary, and technology to the world. It shared it. It didn't come as conquerors. It didn't come to take your land. It didn't come to supplant you or enslave you or exterminate you. It didn't do that. It didn't do that under the name of Christianity, where Europeans came and thanked their God for being able to eliminate you, to massacre you and take your land. It didn't do that. But yet, this is what we've been trained to believe and trained to embrace, because it is the belief that is our salvation. That if you don't believe in this, and see, I had this conversation. I don't talk too much with Christians and so forth, because to me, it's fruitless to try to persuade them to understand history as opposed to the mythology that they embrace, you know. But I always say it this way. Your theology is like this. You rather believe and it not be true than to not believe and it be true. Because if it is true, you'll burn in hell, you know. So I'm gonna ride with the lie. I'm gonna ride with the falsehood. I'm gonna ride with the belief. And particularly what's to me is detrimental is that the face of it, the image of it, is people who have done some evil things to this planet. You know? And I put Europeans at the forefront of that, because they are the ones in their human development had a greedy, selfish, evil mindset, you know, and as they continued to develop, they were always very warlike. In fact, I said this, Brother Sean, many times. I said, one of the things that Caucasians, they've always found a better way to kill your ass. From the very beginning of throwing a rock, to hitting you upside the head with a club, to spears, to swords, to crossbows, to Gatling guns, to terminology and technology of today. They always found a better way to kill your ass. And now they got drones. So any moment they could send a drone right here to Brother Oshie's place and blow my ass up. But that's real, because they have the potential to do it. But to me, I don't fear none of that, because to me, what's most important as far as I'm concerned is the liberation, self-determination, and sovereignty for African people and us controlling our land and controlling our resources. That's what's most important to me, because if we don't, that is our salvation, because if we don't do that, we're going to, damn it, die. We're going to be eliminated.
We have to be orientated towards, you know, it's like the direction that we go through, when we live our lives, that we have to have some kind of purpose that goes back to why are we doing what we're doing? How do we maintain? I mean, it's you know what I'm saying? It's a challenge, you know, just to maintain one's own, you know, operating about it, and then trying to encourage other people to think outside the box and just to contend with other people. I mean, it's the only thing to do.
Yeah, it is. What
I'm gonna hang up. Thank you for your program.
Oh no, thank you, Brother Sean. Continue to listen. I appreciate you. Thank you, brother. I'm gonna just put you on hold. Just hang it, because I might say something else that you might deal with. But we're talking today. And I believe I'll definitely do this again when that time of the year comes of Easter and the Exodus and all that other stuff. Here's another piece I found on the net. Exodus didn't happen. Every history book and every timeline mentions the Exodus. The Exodus and Moses are mentioned in the Gospels of Jesus, the Quran, the Book of Mormon, and the Baha'i faith. People just assume it is a fact. That assumption is based solely on the story told in the Torah. But what if it is wrong? How would we know? The first steps would be to research references outside of the Torah. Unfortunately for those who believe in the biblical account, there are no outside references, even though many Christian, Jews, Muslims, and atheist archaeologists have been digging up the whole Middle East for centuries looking for it. Just like Noah's Ark never found it because it never happened. You know, the archaeologists have not found much. They cannot even agree on a date. Everything from 1550 to 1200 BCE. This makes one inclined to conclude that the Exodus did not really happen. You cannot prove a negative, but the lack of evidence speaks volumes to those who understand. 400 years of captivity. The Torah states very precisely that there were 603,550 males in the Exodus, in Hebrews. That is by the book of Numbers, Numbers 1 and 2. Which means we must guess as to how many men, women, and children there were. Anywhere from 2 million to 6 million. If we just take the lowest number, then 2 million Hebrews who were captives were a large minority in ancient Kemet. 25 to 75% of the total population. No evidence of this huge enslavement, of this enslaved minority, has ever been found. Apparently, no one has ever owned one. No one has ever bought one. No one has ever sold one. There are no records of any transactions which include them. No one even bragged about having many they owned and their tombs in their tomb paintings in the Medunetra. And most important of all, no Hebrew captives were ever buried in Kemet, no matter if the bondage was 430 years, 250 years, or just four generations. There is no evidence of Hebrews in Kemet. The plagues. There have been many who have tried to explain the 10 plagues by using natural phenomenon, but the 10 plagues is something else. Exodus 11, verses 4 through 6 is quite clear about the horror which fell onto Kemet. Every firstborn creature, human or animal, in all of Kemet died in one night of terror. You know, I seen the Exodus, the Ten Commandments movie with Yul Brynner as Ramesses, Charlton Heston as Moses. So many, I saw it at the theater. I saw it with my uncle back in the 60s. I saw the theater. And you know, they had an intermission. It was, I mean, the color. But you, of course, they digitize it now. So when you see it on ABC, ABC shows it around Easter time because that's the time of the Passover in Exodus. And they showed it. And so I continue to watch it. I've seen the Exodus movie with Christian Bale as Moses. I can't remember the Arab dude. He's Israeli, I believe, or Arab. I'm not sure, but he looks Caucasian. He doesn't look African. Who plays Ramesses II? That's who they believe is the Pharaoh that Moses encountered. And of course, if you know anything about Ramesses II, he was for lack of a better word, an egomaniac. He built on a grand scale. When you go down, if you ever had an opportunity and you go down near the Aswan Dam where Lake Nasser is, where they flooded Nubia to make the Aswan Dam, and they had to move. They literally had to move Abu Simbel because if they didn't, it would have been underwater. So they cut it in many pieces like a jigsaw puzzle. In fact, I've always said that once they did that and they moved it to where it is, and when you look at pictures and so forth and video and so forth, you see where it is. It is an engineering feat, no doubt. But where it was, twice a year, the sun would be at a particular height in the horizon that the light of the sun would penetrate into Abu Simbel and illuminate way back the Holy of Holies. Now, what is more of an engineering feat? To build it and make sure that it is placed there at the right time and how you structure it, or cutting it like a jigsaw puzzle and then putting it back again? Yeah, I tell you, we are phenomenal people. Phenomenal people. If that happened today, do you think the news media might mention it? Of course they would. There is no mention of it in Kemetic archaeology. Also, the firstborn of every important Egyptian culture, has they are the ones who must perform the burial rites of their parents, so their parents would enter paradise. That was a part of the culture, the firstborn. So many gone so fast would have devastated the whole nation. Yet no one mentioned it in any writings, any Medunecher, or what the Greeks call hieroglyphs, from official state carvings to personal tombs and journals. Throughout the Kemetic, throughout Kemet, there is nothing. There are also no mass burials for the tens of thousands of the victims that it would have happened to. The Sinai Desert. The Sinai Desert is very dry. There is very little weathering. There is very few visitors. A horde of 2 million people with domestic animals and all kinds of belongings would have left some trace in the desert of the Sinai, specifically around Mount Sinai, where they were encamped for some time while Moses went up to get the Ten Commandments. Of course, in the movie, God, you know, opened up all of that and everything fell into the earth. So maybe that's what happened. Okay. All right. It should be easy to find, yet there is no evidence of any lanterns, no evidence of any trash, no evidence of any dead people buried, even though the entire Exodus generation had to die in the desert before they could reach the promised land due to the golden calf incident. Remember that? Where they made Aaron, Moses' brother, build them a golden calf. No trace of this large city, twice the size of Rome at its height, moving through the entire Sinai Peninsula for 40 years. No trace of a small city either. No trace of any group large enough. They just put this information out there. And even though it defies your rational thinking, it defies logic, it defies everything, but you must believe. You must have faith. You must believe that the Bible is the infallible word of God. And you must have faith. There's no mention of Kemet, occupation of Canaan, anywhere in the Bible. Although Canaan is a part of Kemet. If you look at, once again, the Sinai Peninsula, the Suez Canal was built to separate Kemet or Egypt from the eastern part. That was a landmass, so there's no difference. And you didn't know that you were crossing over into Canaan. It's still part of Egypt. The ancient Kemites had occupied the lands of Canaan and Syria for most of the second millennium. Check any date for the Exodus in any book and you will see that the Hebrews had escaped from Kemet only to settle in Egypt. They escaped Egypt to settle in Egypt. That's what I'm saying. If they were in the area of what is present day Cairo today and they walked east, today they would encounter the Suez Canal as a divide. The Suez Canal connects the Mediterranean to the Red Sea. But back then, there was a huge landmass. So, you know, you're still walking from Kemet going into Kemet.
the peace treaty with Menini and the El Amri tablets show that all Canaan was ruled by the Kemetic, by the Egyptians, from Amenhotep II to Akhenaten. Ramesses the Great and his son, Mentuhotep, fought campaigns there. The last pharaoh to fight a major campaign in Canaan was Ramesses III, who died around 1150 BCE. It is Ramesses III, in his tomb, there is a relief, a picture of four men, where it shows two of the men are the same. They're African, they're black, with close curled hair. One of the men is one of the Indo-Europeans, and the other is the Semite. The Indo-Europeans, of course, became the white people of Europe. The Semite are the Semitic people, or the Arabs, or the whatever. But the two men who are the same are Kemet and the Sudan, or Kush, or Nubia, because they're cousins. They're the same people. They're not different people. They're the same people. The last pharaoh to fight a major campaign in Kemet was Ramesses III, who died around 1150 BCE. If the Hebrews were in Canaan at this time, they would have had a deal. They would have to deal with the Egypt, their older oppressors. Yet, there is no mention of it in Egypt, and no mention of it in the Bible. Also, Hebrews enter Canaan in a genocidal rage, but no word of this slaughter ever got back to Egypt, the land's protector. It would seem that the writers of the Bible had no knowledge of Egyptian occupation of Canaan. The Mentuhotep Stele. Mentuhotep Stele is a stone carving which proudly proclaims the great victories of Pharaoh Mentuhotep during a campaign in Kemet, a campaign in Canaan, along with many other victories of the kings and cities. The Stele mentions the total annihilation of a tribe called the Israelites. It has been dated around 1207 BCE. It is the oldest mentioning of the Israelites in archaeology. The problem with the Stele is that the Israelites are mentioned as people or a tribe and not a nation or city. The victory over Israelites is more of a footnote among the other glory and plunder. It would appear that the Israelites were just a tribe of desert bandits who were plaguing the Egyptian trade routes. No matter who really won the battle, it is strange that the Egyptians write about this battle, but does not appear in the Bible. Well, just like, you know, I ain't gonna write about my defeats. I'm only gonna write about my victories, my glories. The Hebrew language is one of the most studied languages due to its original usage in the Torah. The oldest known evidence of true Hebrew comes from around 800 BCE, which is well after the supposed Exodus, Joshua and Judges and Saul and David and Solomon. Well after that, if it's 800 BCE. Paleo-Hebrew dates to around 1000 BCE. The calendar around the time of David. Tradition says that the Torah was written by Moses himself, which is 400 years. It would be 400 years before that date, 1400 BCE. Unfortunately, the language is not old enough. It would be very difficult to write a book in a language which has not been invented yet. The Israelites were probably still illiterate when Mentuhotep's soldiers attacked around 1207 BCE. There is no Moses character in Kemetic archaeology. It is possible that he may have been erased from history. And of course, many people believe that's what happened, because they're saying that the embarrassment of the Bible, the embarrassment of what happened to them, that they did not write it down or did not put it in Meduneter or hieroglyphs. There have been many pharaohs who have tried to erase the past. Tutmosis III tried to erase his mother, well, it wasn't his mother, Queen Hatshepsut, who had usurped his throne. She ruled for over 20-some years, and this is true. Tutmosis III tried to do that. He defaced some of her statues. And, of course, defaced the statue, they chopped the nose off. But if you can see, just like what Brother Sean said, those statues were solid and smooth to look at. Why? Because they were poured. They weren't chiseled away. They didn't have that. They didn't have the equipment at that time to make something like that. Anyway, she died. He claimed all her accomplishments as his own. Akhenaten and his followers tried to erase the god Amun, even from Akhenaten's own father, Amenhotep III. Akhenaten tried to establish the religion of Atum. Later, Heribun tried to erase the heretic Akhenaten and his successors, including Tutankhamun, while also claiming their accomplishments as his own. We know these things because it is very difficult to erase history from a stone face without leaving any evidence. There is no evidence of any exodus relating hacking. Nothing. The walls of Jericho. There is no evidence of Jericho being inhabited. No ceramics, no buildings, etc. During the last half of the second millennium, the book of Joshua, Jericho was the first city of the Hebrews conquered in Canaan. They collapsed the walls with a great trumpet blast, but the blast would have fallen on deaf ears as Jericho was destroyed by a chariot warrior who swept through there around 1700 BCE. They also did not stay, as Jericho does not become inhabited again until around 900 BCE, well after the time of David and Solomon. The conclusion is this, dear brothers and sisters. Whatever I'm saying here today, you do the research yourself. The information is out there. Yes, you'll come across when you go to research it, where they try to make it seem like, yes, it did happen. We're always trying to find some way, just like they're still trying to find a way to prove the Noah's Ark happened. You know? Do not trust what is written here or the things that I've said. Look it up for yourself. No one is trying to hide this from you. Look up Hebrew slaves in Egypt, the Sinai Peninsula, the Israelites in Canaan. You will come to the same conclusion. The Exodus did not happen. The Exodus did not happen. And what's important is that because you are trained to believe this Abrahamic religion of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, they're all tied. They all have this fundamental belief that these things happen historically. They happen historically. There is no evidence of a man named Yahshua because the letter J had not been invented in the English language, the letter J, until like the 1400s, 15th century. So, it could not be a Jesus. It could not be a Jerusalem. It could not be a Joshua. There's no J. There could not be Jews. There's no J. But there was no proof of a Yahshua or Jesus having lived and done the things that he has been subscribed to do. But yet we are trained to believe that it is true and that it is historical. One of the books, one of the chapters, in the book Urugu, Dr. Marimba Ani, my good friend, Marimba Ani, who's in the motherland, good for her. I called her up just to say, hey, And I called her. She was with Brother Jerry Johnson at the Ancestral Wall. Brother Jerry Johnson is from the U.S. and he's been living in Ghana for many years now. And he has what he called the Ancestral Wall. And it's really beautiful. Those men and women, pictures of them and a synopsis of what they've done. So children in Ghana, they come from Accra, which is the capital city, and they go east to Pram-Pram, where the Ancestral Wall is, going towards the Togo border. And so he has a place you could stay there. I've stayed there. And it's really beautiful. And he's building a library there, you know. But remember Omni's book, Urugu. You know, one chapter is about the theology that they have and how important it is for them to make it real. How important it has to be. It has to be different than other beliefs. This must be something that is substantiated, that is verified, that is historical. This is not a myth. This is not allegory. This is not fairy tale. This is not legend. This is true. This is historical. You know, the other day I was channel surfing and I came across Errol Flynn has Robin Hood. Robin Hood, Robin of Locksley, you know, fighting Basil Rathbone, you know, and the British, if you listen to this program, you know I have deep disdain and disgust for the British, the royal family. They are the true murderers and thieves and robbers on this planet. Them more so than even, the Spanish too, the French definitely, all of them, the Europeans period. But it is the British, the greatest enslavers, what they did in Africa during the colonialism. I can't stand the British. But of course, because they have control of imagery, they have control of the narrative, they have control of information today. People, the royal family, the royals. No, Britain is not racist. It's the fundamental root of racism. Britain, the English. Man. And so, what is said today about them is, you know, glorifying. The queen, how great they are. These are the, you know, when we talk about looting, you show men and women robbing stores, just like in South Africa just recently, going into one of the stores and taking. You've seen it here during last year's uprisings. People stealing, taking. Looting. But when you understand the real looters, robbers, takers, it's Congress. It's the Senate. These politicians. But when you talk about professional looters who have looted the world, you're talking about the colonialists. You're talking about the Europeans. You're talking about Great Britain, particularly. When you see that has all those jewels and crowns and gold and all these things, that none of that is in Europe. None of that is in England. None of that. None of it. But yet they have so much. Each family member has billions of dollars. Well, they're not racist. They're the epitome. So, their religion has to be historical. And those fables, just like King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, it's not true.
William Tell. It's not true. England, those Europeans, particularly the British, they really have no glorious past. So you create one. You turn myth into reality by imposing it on others that it is true, just like the Bible in itself. They said that the Bible is the infallible word of God, and they imposed it upon us on the continent and throughout the diaspora. One of the main impediments from us being independent, self-determining, liberating, and sovereign is the belief in these theologies that they have given us. It prevents us from coming together because, number one, Christian religion particularly is not a unifying religion. It's an individualistic religion. Yeah, you may go to church and your church members, y'all might have a good relationship. Y'all might do things for the pastor and the pastor's family and so forth and have good. But no, I'm talking about us as a collective people to do things for ourselves as African people, regardless of those outside of our religion. That's what I'm talking about. Brothers and sisters, we've come up on the time. I hope that you've enjoyed this presentation. I hope you got something out of it. I know you probably challenged your theology, your belief. I understand that. But one thing that this program strives to do is put us in the mindset of doing for self. The European, the Caucasian, has a vice grip on our minds. And one of the main tools that keeps that vice grip is the theologies that we have been given, that imposes, that has been imposed upon us, that prevents us from seeing clearly, that prevents us from embracing the knowledge of self. We have been trained to say that Egypt is evil, the Egyptians, Pharaoh. We've been trained. The religions speak of Egypt as some bad place, but yet everybody, even supposedly in their Bible, that Jesus went there. If he went into Egypt, obviously Jesus then had to be black because Egypt is black. Joseph and his family, all of them went there. But yet, of course, since that time, and because of the advent of Islam, Egypt is white. Egypt is white. But no, it's not. Egypt is African. Egypt is African. It's black. Brothers and sisters, we end this program like we end all of our programs with the words of Stephen Biko. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind. But not just the M-I-N-D, but the M-I-N-E, because under the feet of African people lies all of the resources that everybody wants, think they can't do without, and they sure in the hell, damn it, don't want to pay for. Brothers and sisters, you have a blessed and wonderful day. Shemhotep means go in peace. Asante Sana means thank you. Bivahodie. Bivahodie means our victorious destiny. Brothers and sisters, we will be victorious. You have a blessed and wonderful, safe weekend. Hope you'll come back with us on Monday. Peace, family.